So anyway, so this is the title that I was given, except for the thing in parentheses. And it wasn't clear to me what the topic was about. So that means I can talk about whatever I want. So this is mostly what I'll try to talk about. And again, just to give you, and I'll say this many times, all of the other talks today will be on neutrino experiments and different aspects of how to get information out of neutrino experiments. What I'll try to do today is just to give you more of a motivational talk, especially concentrating on these quote-unquote low-energy experiments, and the neutrino experiments will play a big part of that. So I will try to remind you of the fact that we're looking for new phenomena, so we want to try to understand nature better, and I'll just try to remind you of what it is that we already know. There's a lot of stuff which I won't talk about, and since I'm not talking about it, I won't read the list, but you can read it. And then, of course, I'll spend a little bit of time talking about looking for new physics with charged leptons. And we already heard about this yesterday, so I'll try to talk in a way that kind of complements a little bit what we heard yesterday. Then I'll talk about new physics in the neutrino sector, and I'll just give you the usual spiel about what these neutrino oscillation experiments are about. And I'll talk a little bit about looking for new phenomena in neutrino oscillations. And the main message will hopefully be that we're trying to do something in the neutrino sector that's very hard. And that means we need to understand things like neutrino interactions and neutrino beams and neutrino detectors way better than we understand them today. And then you understand, especially people who don't work in the neutrino field, why we're so worried about all kinds of more detailed things related to neutrino interactions that people will be talking about a lot, starting with Kevin's talk. So, just as a reminder, we have this thing called the standard model. 99% of the talks in this conference are about how do you take the standard model and calculate things very, very precisely. So I'm not going to talk about that at all. I'm going to talk about the opposite part of that, which is all of the soft, fluffy stuff that's really easy to do. So that's my job. That's my self-assigned job. So that's what I'm doing. So let me remind you of the fact that we live in interesting times, but they're also sort of confusing times. So in some sense, we have this very, very nice looking model that works ridiculously well. And again, it's nice to stop and sort of take stock of how well this works. I mean, you can use this idea of fundamental particles with a handful of fundamental interactions that are very easy to describe and heavily constrained. So we have all of these gauge interactions, for example. And we can explain phenomena that span many, 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 many orders of magnitude, which is absolutely amazing. I think if you went back and you talked to, I don't know, Schrodinger or Bohr or some of these people, and you told them, hey, you know, this model that you guys started, you know, 100 years from now, we'll be able to calculate with 10 significant digits everything, they're going to tell you that you're crazy, because their experience is just the opposite. So the fact that this works really well is exciting, but it's frustrating. And there are certain things that don't work, but there are very, very few things that don't work. And you all know what those are. Many of those have to do with funny cosmological observations. And some of those are sort of a peripheral particle physics problems in some sense, because they don't have anything to do with particles, as far as we can tell. But they are things that we hoped we would have a solution for, but we don't know what they are. You know, they have to do with things like the fact that the expansion rate of the universe can accelerate. We have evidence for that today. And we think that this happened in the early universe as well. We don't know how this happened. We know how to parameterize it, but that's as much as we can do. Then there's this thing called the dark matter. It seems to exist. And we're very sure that it's not something that's made out of particles that are in the standard model. Then there's a more technical question that we in particle physics like to talk about at all, a lot, which has to do with the fact that the universe has more matter than antimatter. This, again, is another cosmology-related question. And when you talk to lay people, you know, people that are not in physics, it's really hard to convince them that, A, this is a problem, and B, that it's a particle physics problem. Because it feels a lot like an initial conditions problem. You know, if you tell people, hey, the universe has more matter than antimatter, they'll tell you, so what? Because it started that way, and that's how life goes, and we shouldn't be asking that sort of question. But what's interesting is that we understand particle physics so well, and we have a good picture of how the universe has evolved as a function of time, that we sort of need to do this, even if we don't want to. And again, people hopefully are familiar with this. And again, we pretty much think this is a particle physics problem. And that leads us to look for things like new sources of CP violation and so on. And of course, the thing number four, which is the one that I'll talk about the most, is that neutrino masses turn out to be not zero. And this is something that was kind of a surprise. And we're still trying to figure out how does that happen. And by the way, this is another thing that when you talk to lay people, it's hard to explain to them why anything having a mass is a question. Because everything is a mass, and it's silly to ask where do the masses come from. But somehow, for particle physics, this is kind of a big deal. So the real question, which I think is the motivation for me talking here, is to asking ourselves, how do we learn more? So we know that something happens, and we know that we need a new degrees of freedom to explain these phenomena, and we want to know what these degrees of freedom are. So let me just very quickly remind you of the thing that I'll talk about the most is about neutrino physics. And again, the evidence for new physics that's coming from the neutrino sector is neutrino oscillations. So you've all heard about this a million times. We know for sure that neutrinos can change flavor as a function of position, as a function of distance traveled, and as a function of energy. The evidence for this is absolutely overwhelming. We can now do almost precision measurements of this phenomenon. And the only way we can explain this is by assuming that the neutrinos have non-zero mass and that the leptons mix. And I'm not going to dwell on this because we know this really well. Now, the situation is very interesting because we can translate these oscillation probabilities into neutrino masses, or actually into differences of neutrino masses. And if we combine more information that we have, we know that the neutrino masses are at the electron volt level. They're actually in the sub-electron volt level. They're known to be below, say, 0.1 electron volts or so. And this is in stark contrast with the rest of the standard model fermions that all have masses that are, in units of electron volts, very, very heavy. And again, as you know very well, even the electron mass is pretty heavy in neutrino units. It's about a million times heavier than the largest possible neutrino mass you can come up with. And all of the other standard model fermion masses are way heavier than that. Now, there's another thing that people like to So the reason I'm talking about this is the fact that not only are neutrino masses very small, they're also kind of isolated in this mass space. And this is something that people pay a lot of attention to. But one thing that's interesting to look at is the fact that if you look at this mass space in the charge, the fermion bases, let's say, the mass space is more or less evenly populated in a log scale. That's a cheap statement that doesn't mean very much. But if you stare at the same log space, you notice that the space between, say, the electron mass and the largest possible neutrino mass does not seem to be populated at all. Okay, and again, this could be a coincidence. It could mean nothing. But the combination of the fact that the masses are very small with this really big gap that lives here leads people to believe, and this is a belief and not a theorem, that neutrino masses may come from a very, very different origin than all of the other charged fermion masses. And this is another reason to be excited. So what's exciting about this problem as well is even though we've known for neutrino masses for about 20 years now, is that we still don't know how neutrino masses happen. So even if you buy into the standard model with a Higgs boson, which is a good thing to buy in, it's a good model, you should buy into that. Even if you buy into that model, we still don't know what the right model for non-zero neutrino masses is. We have too many choices. And the experimental data that we have access to today doesn't tell us what the right model is supposed to be. And this is kind of exciting and frustrating because we've probably talked about or thought about all of the different possible models that we could come up with, and they all work. Again, that's by definition, because if they didn't work, we wouldn't be talking about them anymore. But all the models that we consider still work, and they work very well, and they have completely different phenomenology. So, in order to make progress here, we're probably going to need more experimental data. And again, what makes this a point in time as far as particle physics is concerned is the fact that we actually don't know what kind of experimental data we need. And it's the same thing with the dark matter. So we know, or we're particle physics people that don't know enough about astrophysics, believe that the evidence for dark matter is absolutely ironclad and really strong, so we need new particles. And now we have to look for them. And we don't know how to do it, or we can think of 20 different ways of doing it. And that's sort of what we're doing. We're trying lots of different things out, and we're hoping that one of those things will work out. With the neutrino masses, it's sort of the same. Now, for people who've never thought about this, and I think it's nobody in this room, but I'll say this anyway, here's why neutrino masses are interesting, is that when it comes to giving neutrinos a non-zero mass, there are lots of ways to do it which are qualitatively different. The simplest way to do it, depending on who you ask, is just to have the neutrinos have a Yukawa coupling to the Higgs boson, just like everybody else. This is an interesting thing to do because you have to invent a new field that's not in the standard list of fields in the standard model, something like a right-handed neutrino, and you also need to come up with a very small coupling. There's nothing wrong with that. That's fine. And I'll talk a little bit more about this in a little while. But this is option number one. There's a separate option, which is maybe there's a new Higgs boson that we haven't seen yet, and maybe the neutrinos talk to that one, and for some reason that Higgs boson can only give masses to neutrinos. And if you've never thought about this, it sounds like an unusual proposition, but it's very easy to do that. There's a particular scalar field that you can write down that only talks to fermions with one Yukawa coupling, and that Yukawa coupling gives the neutrinos a Majorana mass. That's a Higgs triplet field with non-zero hypercharge. So that would be interesting, because if that was the case, we're saying there's one Higgs boson that we haven't seen yet, the neutrinos only talk to that Higgs boson, that would explain why the neutrino masses are very different. That's kind of exciting. And it also gives you something to look for, which is a new Higgs boson, which is also kind of nice. The third option is the one that we're all very familiar with, but it's also the more convoluted one. Another possibility for why neutrino masses are very different is that maybe they speak to another source of mass in the standard model that has nothing to do with electroweak symmetry breaking. By the way, if you did have a new Higgs with non-zero hypercharge, that would also contribute to electroweak symmetry breaking, of course. But maybe the neutrinos are speaking to a different source of mass that's completely divorced from electroweak symmetry breaking. And maybe the neutrino masses are a combination of the standard model VEV and some new source of mass. This is a very exciting proposition, because this would be evidence of a new mass scale in nature. And again, in some sense, this is kind of what we look for. You know, we like to identify, you know, when do you get to a new mass scale, when something interesting happens. And that would be unambiguous evidence for that, if we could determine that option number three happens to be correct.
I have a naive question.
Yes?
So if we live in a world where option number two is really true, is it absolutely the case that neutrinos are Majorana? Or could you have a Dirac neutrino?
They would definitely be Majorana if it manifests itself in this way. So again, this is a nice renormalizable theory that you can write down. It has a new particle in it. It gets a VEV, and then the neutrinos get a mass that way.
So it looks like the same Higgs that we know and love, but they're Majorana because...
So it's a different Higgs.
Right, different Higgs, but it's otherwise the same, quote unquote.
It has properties that are predictable via the standard model interactions, for example. Okay. So you can discuss how this thing couples to the W and the Z in a totally prescribed way.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
So it's... Of course, sadly, that Higgs could be very heavy. So it may be impossible to see in a collider experiment, for example. But nonetheless, it might exist. And as you just alluded to, there's kind of a smoking gun difference between some of these scenarios, and it has to do with whether the neutrinos are Dirac or Majorana fermions. So figuring that out is a very big deal. And still, as you notice, the space of possibilities is quite large. So the challenge for people who like phenomenology and for learning how nature actually works, you have to ask yourself, what sort of experiments do you have to be doing in order to find out what's going on? So like I said, Majorana versus Dirac is sort of a big deal. This is one of the things I won't talk about, but I'll talk about it just a little bit. And that has to do with searches for neutrino-less double beta decay. So again, the best way to find out if the neutrinos are Majorana fermions or not is to ask whether lepton number is absolutely conserved or not. We have lots of ways of doing that, Many of those involve, say, rare meson decays, other rare nuclear processes. But in some sense, the only game in town with lots of quotes is looking for neutrinoless double beta decay. And the reason it's the only game in town is just by how sensitive it is. You know, it overshadows all of the other searches for lepton number violation by many orders of magnitude. Doesn't mean the other searches are not important. It just means that they are a very different kind of bet. I don't want to talk too much about a neutrinoless double beta decay other than to say that if we saw that neutrinoless double beta decay happens, then we would know that lepton number is violated. And for 99% of the population, that would mean that the neutrinos are Majorana fermions. It's not a theorem, sadly. You can do all kinds of convoluted, complicated things to have the neutrino not be the source of this neutrinoless double beta decay. But we're not going to talk about this possibility. I do want to mention one thing which is important, mostly in the nuclear physics community, which is this is a great place to determine if the neutrinos are Majorana or Dirac, looking for neutrinoless double beta decay. A different question or a different set of questions are two questions which are highly related. One is, imagine you don't see it. Then what do you learn? And what you normally learn is that either the neutrinos are Dirac or their masses have to be in a certain range. And in order to make a quantitative statement, you have to be able to translate not seeing double beta decay into a bound on the neutrino mass. That requires nuclear physics. And it requires something that's not easy to calculate. And it hasn't been calculated very well yet. And it's kind of a big deal question. And I think that the particle physics community has been trying to convince the nuclear physics community for a long time that it would be nice if we knew what the answer was, you know, within 30% or so. So that's a big question on calculating these nuclear matrix elements for neutrinoless double beta decay. The same is true if the opposite happens. You know, imagine that we see neutrinoless double beta decay. Can we convert that on some information about the neutrino masses? And in order for us to do that, we would have to know what these nuclear matrix elements are. Otherwise, the error bars are sort of a factor of two or something like that. So I do want to say that even if we determined that the neutrinos, say, are Majorana fermions, that still wouldn't tell us what the theory is. We would still need more help. And let me go through this very, very briefly just to give you a feel for what does it mean to have a theory for neutrino masses. So I'll walk through very, very quickly a theory about neutrino masses that you know very well. And then I'll try to give you a flavor of what kind of phenomenology do you expect. OK, so I'll talk about the model that everybody knows. And I'll start out with what's called the Weinberg operator. So the idea is something that we're very familiar with. Even if you just work with standard model physics, we care about effective theories. And if you take the standard model and you consider that to be an effective theory, you can start adding higher dimensional operators to the standard model Lagrangian. And it turns out that there's one dimension 5 operator that you can write down. It's this one. It's a lepton Higgs squared operator. That's dimension 5. All the other operators are higher dimensional than that. What's very interesting is if you like effective field theories, you can then ask yourself, so if the standard model is an effective theory, what is an interesting consequence of this effective theory? And again, you start out with the dimension 5 operator, because that's the lowest dimensional operator there is. And then you ask, at low energies, what does this operator do that's interesting? And what it does is, below the electric symmetry breaking scale, this operator looks like this. It's a mass term neutrino-neutrino. And that means if you believe that the standard model is a generic effective field theory, then there's a prediction, which is that neutrinos are expected to get a Majorana mass. The Majorana mass is proportional to the weak scale squared divided by some unknown new physics scale that has to do with the effective theory scale. And this is exciting for lots and lots of reasons. One is that it's a good prediction that you can make. It appears to be correct if you compare it with experiment, except that we don't know if the neutrinos are Majorana or Dirac. And it has this really interesting feature that if you look at the neutrino masses, they are suppressed relative to charged fermion masses by a factor that goes like the weak scale squared divided by some new physics scale. And then what this model then predicts are that neutrino masses are not zero, and neutrino masses are very small. I showed you the data that we have, and the data says that neutrino masses are not zero, and neutrino masses are very small. So that's kind of exciting. Now, this was first written down by Weinberg in 1979, when he started asking about higher dimensional operators. And if you ask around, most people are willing to believe that this is what's giving neutrinos a non-zero mass. There's some physics at some UV scale somewhere. You integrate out the new degrees of freedom. You get this dimension 5 operator. It explains that neutrino masses are very small and that the neutrinos are Majorana fermions. So this is all great. The question is, can we test this? And life is hard because neutrino masses are too small. So you can make so if you try to figure out naively what this number lambda is, you can plug in the numbers, and you get the number 10 to the 14 GeV. So this is the effective scale where neutrino masses are coming from. So we don't know how to do experiments at 10 to the 14 GeV. That's very hard. But on the other hand, we have to try to understand what 10 to the 14 GeV means. And what it means is there's some new degrees of freedom out there, and we have to run into them before we get to 10 to the 14 GeV. This is kind of like the weak scale as well, right? So if you were doing, say, a muon decay when the muon was discovered, you would have figured out that the Fermi constant is 1 over 246 GeV squared. And if you interpret that, and again, this is an effective theory, and you ran into this mass scale, you would have learned that just by measuring muon decay, you would have learned that there has to be some new particle out there, and we have to run into it before we get to 246 GeV. That's what muon decay says. And of course, we know how history went. We did run into a new particle at around 80 GeV. That's the W boson. And 80 is not 246, although it's pretty close to 246. But when people started looking for the W boson, you know, I think the first, so when people talked about these vector bosons at the time in the 60s and the 70s, the first bounds on these vector bosons come from things like kaon decay. You can look for kaon decay. You can ask if the kaon decays into a W boson. It doesn't. So you know that the W boson is heavier than the kaon mass, approximately. So that's how you start. And then you started looking for it until you got to 80 GeV.
So you're taking, y to be, you're normalizing y to be 1.
Well, remember,
it's only y over lambda.
Only y over lambda is physical. So I can define lambda only if I make some ansatz about y. And then I just say, let the largest y be 1. And that tells me what lambda is supposed to be.
Because I'm thinking about always when having these kind of discussions, this thing we know from the sound about the gym mechanism that leads to gym suppression, where the coefficients are kind of smaller than you might think.
Yep, so absolutely. And this can happen. I'll try to give some example of that. Now, the simplest realization of this Weinberg operator you're probably also familiar with, and it's a very simple model. It's the model of taking the standard model Lagrangian and adding gauge singlet fermions. So you add gauge singlet fermions to the model. Gauge singlet fermions can talk to the Higgs and a lepton doublet this way. This is a neutrino-Yukawa coupling. But gauge singlet fermions are also allowed to have Majorana masses. There you go. And this is the entire renormalizable Lagrangian that you can write down, except for a kinetic energy term for the gauge singlet fermion. So you take this theory and you ask, what does this theory do for you? It also does something interesting. These guys have non-zero Majorana masses. They couple to standard model neutrinos after the Higgs gets a VeV. So this model has 6 neutrino degrees of freedom in it, if you add 3 of those. By the way, we can add as many of those as we like. These are gauge singlet fermions. They don't contribute to anomalies or anything bad. So you can add 1, 2, 3, 27 of those, as many as you like. And if you do that, then this is a very nice model because it tells you that there's 6 fermions out there, neutrino-like degrees of freedom, and they're all Majorana fermions. Again, it's a nice model because it seems to be halfway towards allowing us to explain the data. And of course, in order to understand the phenomenology of this model, you have to understand what the new Yukawa couplings are, and you have to understand what the new masses are. So of course, by varying these parameters independently, you can try to fit to the data. And by the way, just as an aside, if this mass scale is heavy-ish, you can integrate out these right-handed neutrino degrees of freedom, or these are Gates-Singlet fermion degrees of freedom. You get this operator here, the one that I was talking about before, and now you have a prediction for what lambda is supposed to be. It's a three-level integration process. So lambda is the mass of these neutrinos divided by lambda squared. And remember, I said that big lambda has to be 10 to the 14 GeV. And again, I don't have to tell you that there are three different ways of making this number be 10 to the 14 GeV. The third way is harder to understand. So one possibility is that maybe all these lambdas are 1, and this m is 10 to the 14 GeV. That will work. The other way is maybe m is not 10 to the 14 GeV, but it's something a lot smaller. And this lambda becomes very, very large because the little lambda is very, very small. So again, the ways that we like to say this is that either the new physics is very, very heavy, or the new physics is very, very weakly coupled. And both of these possibilities give you very small neutrino masses. The third possibility is more weird because this turns out to be a matrix equation. So it is possible that when you multiply out these matrices, you end up with very small numbers in them, because you know that matrices know how to do that. And it's possible that there's symmetries, there's sort of accidental symmetries in the Lagrangian that make that happen, for example. So very, very different scenarios, and they actually lead to different expectations as well. So just as an example, here is the space of right-handed neutrino masses. And what's plotted here is how much these new neutrino degrees of freedom mix with what we call the standard model neutrinos. So again, like I said, you have these six new neutrino degrees of freedom. They're all heavily mixed. And the ones that we know about are the new e, the new mu, and the new tau. So we're inventing some new neutrino degrees of freedom. So we better not be able to discover them because we haven't seen them yet. So if this is the situation that we're in, this is the mass space for this model over here. And what happens is, if this mass is really, really light, like below 10 to the minus 10 electron volts, this is a good fit to the data. You can explain all of the neutrino oscillation data, and everything works out fine. Okay, so very, very small masses are here. And this goes all the way to m equals 0 when the neutrinos happen to be Dirac fermions. And there's a symmetry that protects that. On the flip side, if these right-handed neutrino masses are above 1 electron volt or so, unless you like cosmology, in which case you have to go above 1 MeV or so. But if you're above 1 electron volt or so, this also fits all of the data that we have. All the way up to, this is in electron volts, by the way, this goes all the way up to about 10 to the 15 GeV. And if you get to 10 to the 15 GeV, it doesn't work anymore because the neutrino masses are too small. Okay, or that means that the theory would be so strongly coupled that that's probably not a good description of the phenomenon that you're trying to explain. So you have this frustrating situation where you wrote down a Lagrangian. The Lagrangian has two new parameters in it, a Yukawa coupling and a mass. And the parameter space that's allowed that explains non-zero neutrino masses is any value of this mass below 10 to the minus 10 electron volts, and any value of this mass between 1 electron volt and 10 to the 15 GeV. That's your model space from a very, very simple model. On the flip side, this region of the parameter space is ruled out. So that's nice. You know, there's a big region of parameter space that's ruled out by neutrino oscillations.
Why again?
So what happens here is, here, the mixing between the active neutrinos and the stereoneutrinos is very strong, and it's actually calculable. And it's ruled out mostly by solar neutrino experiments all the way until here or so. And here it's ruled out by terrestrial and atmospheric neutrino experiments. And what's interesting is, if you ask what happens here at the boundary, is you have stereoneutrinos that are on the verge of being discovered. And it's also true here. Here you have stereoneutrinos that are on the verge of being discovered. So by doing new experiments looking for stereoneutrinos, either at a really long oscillation length or at terrestrial, you know, meter-like sizes for things, then you should be able to see something. This also goes for neutral heavy leptons, which Doug talked about yesterday in his talk as well. So these guys could be neutral heavy leptons that live here. And of course, what happens is, as you start going that way, this guy gets very heavy, but this effective mixing becomes tiny. And then this guy starts to be really hard to look for.
Still, probably from a few keV to 100 MeV, it's always favored by cosmology.
In this space here, you have to, cosmology has to do something weird for this to work out, absolutely.
Yeah, also some constraints from X-rays.
That's what I'm talking about, yeah. That's exactly what I'm talking about. So it starts out with ineffective constraints and constraints that have to do with the sum of the neutrino masses, all the way down to the fact that this thing would have been a good dark matter candidate, except for two things. One is, if you do this model naively, it's actually not a good dark matter candidate because there are too many of those guys left over. It's too good. And you would have seen them by looking for X-rays from places where you have a lot of dark matter.
So future neutrino or whatever, near future neutrino program is changing or just increasing the red region?
I would argue that it's giving you, it's starting to push in this direction here, if you want to look at it in this language. And I will say, this cosmology bounds do rely on the physics of the right-handed neutrinos being as vanilla as possible. Because if these guys have new interactions or something exciting going on, then life is different.
The push to the right, it would be mostly from a short baseline?
So a short baseline experiments live here. And then these are neutral heavy lepton things. If you can get to very, very tiny mixing angles, which is the challenge. So we're talking about mixing angles in the 10 to the minus 6 like regime. And there are experiments that will get there barely. Things like the ship experiment, for example. If it ever happens, it would be starting to touch the region of a mixing angle space where life is interesting. I'm not advocating for that, but it is a possibility.
There is a gap between where the cosmology bounds center. So how low do they
go? So the gap is at this 10 keV region or so. So especially for these searches for neutral heavy leptons, you do have sensitivity in things like kaon experiments and charm experiments and so on. You do have this region where at the MeV region, you might be able to learn more than we know today. Maybe. It's if I were in the sales business, I would have a hard time selling that. But it is a logical possibility.
What's happening on the left when it's getting incredibly light?
Yeah.
How's that square? It's incredibly weakly.
You mean these very small masses?
Yeah.
So again, remember, this is the Majorana mass for the right-handed neutrino. It's a new parameter in the Lagrangian. It can be whatever number you like. And it's a protected number, by the way. So if this number is very small, this 10 to the minus 10 level, in this regime, the neutrinos are called the pseudo-Dirac particles. That means that the neutrinos would form a Dirac pair, but that Dirac pair is just a slightly split, and the mixing is 50-50. And from a neutrino oscillation's point of view, there's a new oscillation frequency with a delta m squared, which is of order this number here, times the other mass. So let's just take this number here. And that's why the solar neutrino experiments, they don't see an oscillation length, which is the size of the solar system. And that's where this bound comes from. If you wanted to improve on that, you would have to be more clever. So you need neutrinos that are coming from further away than the solar system. And there are some bounds you can infer from things like a supernova neutrinos. And if you're more clever, you might be able to do something better. There are no cosmology bounds, by the way, because this coupling is so small, the right-handed neutrinos are never populated in the early universe. So that's not a problem. But yeah, so making progress here is really hard. And of course, you could argue, 10 to the minus 10 is just as bad as 10 to the minus 12, or 10 to the minus 26, or something like that.
If I go to 100 eV,
yeah,
there are probably no X-ray bounds.
Correct.
Are there sort of warmish dark matter?
That's the problem. It's the hot dark matter bound.
But is it excluding this?
Pretty much, yeah.
Particular C cells?
So the problem is these neutrinos get...
I'm not trying to make it dark matter.
No, I understand, but you can't avoid it. That's the problem. Yeah. And the issue is the mixing is still large enough that they get populated by mixing in the early universe. And then they will look like a hot dark matter. And then there's the standard bounds on that. So there is no gap here where you survive cosmology bounds, unless you start doing.
Right. Even if there is something at 1 eV, you have to start doing tricks, right?
Correct, yeah. And again, people know what the tricks could be. And I'm not willing to not think about this region just because of these cosmology bounds. But that's a personal statement. OK. I do want to say that there are many, many more models that I can write down. So for example, in this type of model, when you're integrating out the new degree of freedom at tree level, you have this effective mass scale associated to the problem that is in this 10 to the 14 GeV region. But there are many, many other models you can write down where the neutrino masses get generated at the loop level. And you can say, but that sounds very unlikely. And then we don't know how it's going on, so it's quite just as likely as anything else, except that it's very ugly. If you play with models like that, then the effective scale of the new physics can be much, much lower. So you have this whole range of effective scales depending at what loop level the neutrino masses get generated. So this is described in terms of effective operators. So these are dimension 7 operators, and neutrino masses are usually generated at one loop. Dimension 9 operators at two loops. Dimension 11 operators at three loops. And you can keep going, and you can do this forever. And you notice at the effective scale, that means that even if your model is strongly coupled, the masses of the new particles that you're introducing have to be at this level. That's getting into an interesting regime where these particles are supposed to be doing other stuff. Many of those are charged under the standard model quantum numbers. So you expect to maybe produce them at colliders. They can impact observables like EDMs or charged lepton flavor violation or G-2. And these models are really, really ugly because they have to explain why neutrino masses happen at, say, two loops. But nonetheless, you can write them down. There's even organizing principles you can use. And what's fun about these models is that many of them are falsifiable. That means you can do experiments and you can rule them out. And most of the experiments have nothing to do with neutrinos. They come from something completely different.
I'm sorry, I'm not understanding this plot. So yeah. What else have you assumed?
So good. So this is a histogram.
Yes.
So that means we classify all of the different models using effective operators. And then we ask if there's new physics that manifests itself at low energies in the form of this effective operator, which is, for example, dimension 7, what should the mass scale of the operator be so that I get the right neutrino masses? So it's the same thing with the seesaw mechanism that I did before. I write down a dimension 5 operator. I get this 10 to the 14 GeV so that the neutrino masses match. Here I do the same thing. I say that there's new physics that manifests itself at the tree level as a dimension 7 operator. I use a dimension 7 operator to infer what the neutrino masses are supposed to be at the one loop level. And then I read off what the mass scale is supposed to be. And then this plot is a histogram because there are lots of operators. And for example, there are 12 models of dimension 11 that have an effective scale that's about 100 GeV. That's what this is supposed to mean. So I hope this is more or less clear.
But then what happens to the inverse seesaw on these type of models?
Oh, they're not included there. Yeah,
so you're assuming that there is no extra symmetry or anything.
That's correct, yeah.
That's so
absolutely. So there's a lot of models that are included kind of here in this little box over here. Well, they're included
this
in. No, we are
looking
at models that manifest themselves as higher dimensional operators. And we classify the dimension of the operator by which operator gets generated at the tree level that violates lepton number. So the idea is I add some new fermions. These new fermions are heavy, or new particles. They can be exchanged.
So the pink, for example, is a model which you declare to be a tree-level Lagrangian starting with dimension 11.
Correct, yeah.
OK, and then you'd say that's, but are the other ones forbidden by some symmetry?
So we don't ask that question. We postulate that just happens. But they, of course, get generated at the loop level. You can't forbid that. But that means that there's a hierarchy. The hierarchy between the different higher dimensional operators is governed by loop factors and by standard model interactions.
And so the number 13 in the first bin, how would you find that number 13?
Oh, that's how many different operators there are that are associated with this effective scale. And I'm happy to talk about this more if people are interested. But what you're asking is different. So there are models where you have new light degrees of freedom. I can't talk about those because I don't allow new light degrees of freedom. And then there are also models where you play with the matrix. And that's what, say, the inverse seesaw does. Yeah. And at the end of the day, you still get the dimension 5 operator at the 3 level, except that the way that you got there was had some steps in the middle. And so I can't read off what that physics would be by just looking at the effective operator. So there are possibilities that there is physics that you can test, but my effective operator analysis doesn't reveal that.
Sorry, I'm just still trying to understand. This is standard model field content, or what?
Yeah. So you take the standard model and you write down higher dimensional operators that violate lepton number.
Okay, but then you have to add some rules.
Right, and the rule is my new physics does not generate that at the 3 level. And that's easy to do. I just have to add, you know, it's kind of like a little Higgs model. Or is that what they're called? It's the idea that you only break lepton number if you turn on all of the different couplings in your model. If you turn off any of the couplings, lepton number is not violated. So that means you need all these couplings to exist in order to break lepton number. And that means that at the 3 level, you only break lepton number in a very, very high dimensional operator. Of course, at the loop level within the standard model, I still get the dimension 5 operator, but it's calculable. Or not calculable, but I can estimate it. OK? And again, all I wanted to do is to say that there are lots of different ways that I can give neutrinos a mass. And the new physics particles don't have to be very, very weakly coupled, or very, very heavy. They can be at the TeV level, or at the 100 TeV level, and so on and so forth. OK. So I think I've said this already. This is all. What I really wanted to say is that we have a difficult problem because it can be solved in lots and lots of different ways. And in order for us to learn more, we'll probably need help from lots of different kinds of experiments. And there are no guarantees that we're going to get any help from anybody. But that's life. So I want to talk about muons just very briefly. We heard a lot about this from Doug yesterday. Muon experiments are very important. This is a really nice plot about measuring the muon lifetime as a function of time. And this here is the QED precision of the calculation. And this is the level that we are now. And this thing called the Moulin experiment has measured the muon lifetime at a level that's consistent with the theoretical calculations that have been performed. And there's a reason why this is very important, is that this gives you the best bound that we have on G Fermi. So as you know, you can define the standard model in such a way that G Fermi is an input to the standard model.
It's where you extract G Fermi.
That's what I said.
This is the most precise.
I'm sorry.
Right? It's always going to be consistent.
I didn't say, I said it incorrectly, but that's exactly what I meant. G Fermi comes from this. And it is nice if all of these things are measured very well. And G Fermi is kind of the Achilles heel of the standard model right now, of the standard model parameters. If you look at the fundamental inputs to the standard model, G Fermi is the one that's measured the less well, if I remember this correctly. You guys know this better than me. So.
Oh, it's measured very well. Yeah. It's super well. It's the
but compared
thing,
to what?
Right? So if we could redo, like, say, the Z-peak experiments with hundreds times or thousands times more statistics, then eventually we would match that accuracy. Right?
Really?
And so the all electroweak tests would be. You can view it as an anchor for electroweak tests. So this is done the best.
Okay. That's not, I remember the opposite.
More things like top mass, alpha.
No, that's not, forget your Kalb couplings.
Yeah, no, this is the it's one part per few parts.
No, but alpha is better.
Alpha is better.
The Z mass is better.
No, the Z mass I don't think so.
I don't think so.
No.
Okay. There is not enough statistics there, right? I mean, so at lab you had how many Z's? Just by counting Z's, you can see that you can't do it better than a few MP problems.
Z mass is log 10 to the minus 5, I believe.
Okay.
That's right. So it's an MEV.
All right, I stand corrected.
Yeah.
But it's a hard measurement, by the way. To do a G Fermi at this level is hard. And we also heard about the G minus 2 as well, so I'm not going to dwell on this very much. Again, this is why people are excited about this, is the fact that the current experiments differ from the different theoretical expectations. And so let me just say this very briefly. You can understand how this has to do with new physics by looking at higher dimensional operators. A contribution to the muon G minus 2 is an effective operator that looks like that. If you want to do it at the standard model, you need a Higgs field there because it's a left-right operator. So that's why we tend to parameterize the scale of new physics proportional to mu in the numerator. And if you ask yourself, how do I explain this with new physics, you need a new physics scale that's 10 TeV. That's not very heavy at all. There's one thing which is fun, is that you can do the same. You can do this to estimate the electroweak contribution as well. And the electroweak contribution, 1 over lambda squared, is this combination of, say, the W mass, a loop factor, and fundamental constants. And if you plug this in, this is what you get for the contribution to delta A mu. And if you had made this guess, you would have been almost completely correct, up to a factor of 5/2 or something like that. And what's interesting is the W contribution also is associated to a lambda scale, which is about 10 TeV. That's also something important to keep in mind. If there is new physics in G minus 2, and it's as strongly coupled as the weak interactions, then the new masses in the problem have to be of order the W mass. That's why it's not easy to write down models for that, unless you start going for very light physics, or unless you start playing with things like maybe this is not proportional to mu, but it's proportional to some other heavier mass. And that's what, say, SUSY models do with the large tan beta regime, for example. So there are other things you can measure. You can measure, say, the muon electric dipole moment using the same storage ring. Or you can have a dedicated run to look for the muon electric dipole moment. It's fun to ask yourself whether that's a good idea or not. And first of all, it's the usual story. The standard model expectation for the muon EDM is really small. So it's one of those things that if you see something, you know you found new physics. The current bound is kind of crappy in these units. It's 10 to the minus 19. And the electron bound, as everybody knows, is below 10 to the minus 28 E centimeters. So there's a lot of room to go between the muon and the electron bound, which of course is not a surprise. Now, the reason people pause and say, should we try to measure the muon better? One reason for pausing is the fact that if you have new physics and the new physics scales like the charged lepton mass, then you can take this bound on the electron EDM and you can convert it into an effective bound on the muon EDM, which is worse by a factor of the muon mass divided by the electron mass. And that's still pretty close to 10 to the minus 28. So if you could do the muon EDM at 10 to the minus 21 or 10 to the minus 24, you would probably not do better, in quotes, than this indirect estimate that you can get from the electron EDM bound. So if you want to convince your experimental friends that this is a worthwhile endeavor, you have to explain why the muon EDM from new physics could be abnormally high compared with the electron EDM for new physics. And people, of course, know how to build models that do that. So that's the end of that story. It's interesting to compare the muon EDM effective operator with the G minus 2 effective operator. The operators look the same, except that one violates CP, the other one doesn't. So if the new physics violates CP, then it's very unlikely that there's something going on in the muon G minus 2, because we would have seen it before in these muon EDM searches. So somehow there has to be some penalty factor in the new physics for violating CP. And that's one way of thinking about these kinds of operators as well.
No. The muon G minus 2 is in units of 10 minus 23, 24 centimeters, right? But if you just
that's what I don't remember, so, yeah. So, this is what you would start to probe then at the same scale, yeah, if you got
right,
there.
So you have to really increase the accuracy in the CPU aligning channel to even match it.
Okay. So this statement
is the reverse compared to electron.
I was going to say, yeah. So this statement is absolutely true for the electron. Yeah. Good. Thank you. I had forgotten about that. So let me just say a few words about charged lepton flavor violation. We also heard from Doug about this. We've been looking for it for a very long time, and we haven't seen it yet. The motivation has evolved as a function of time. In the beginning, people were interested in learning whether the muon was an excited electron. Later on, they figured out that it wasn't, and then they were very puzzled by the fact that the decay didn't happen at the loop level, and that led for you to invent a new neutrino. And once we invented a second neutrino, all of these are searches for new phenomena. And we haven't seen it yet. I did want to show this since we didn't get to see the data before, just because I thought people would be interested. So this is the MAG experiment. They're looking for mu to E gamma. This is what you're looking for. It's a stopped muon that goes into E gamma. So it looks like something that's very easy to look for. Because you know everything that there is to know about this electron, you know everything that there is to know about this gamma, theoretically. So you know exactly what you're looking for. You know that they have to come at the same time, and you know that they have to be back to back. The backgrounds are radiative muon decay, where the two neutrinos come out with very, very little energy and momentum. And you have these annoying accidental backgrounds where two muons are doing something at the same time. One of them gives you a positron, and the other one gives you a photon somehow, either by this radiative decay or just by having a positron hit something and give you a photon. And this is the data, and this gives you a sense of how hard this experiment is. This is the E plane, E gamma, E electron plane. This is the timing versus opening angle plane. And the signal region is here. So the signal region gives you a sense of what kind of precision they have with measuring these energies. And that's what defines the signal region. The same is true with the angle and the timing. And all of these circles are data. So they're all events that they have observed. And if you stare at this, you appreciate the fact that they are, in many quotes, in trouble already, because they have all of this background that's already pouring into the signal region in a very significant way, which means that if you want to do this experiment better, you have to find a way of taking these blue regions and making them smaller. So you have to improve your experiment in a very non-trivial way. And you also appreciate this fact that I think we mentioned in discussions at some level that running longer or having more muons isn't going to help. Because if you start doing that, then the number of red points will just get bigger. And that is not a good way to improve on this bound. So let me skip this. This is, I think Doug talked about this. This is the smallest possible contribution from the physics. It has to do with non-zero neutrino masses for things like mu to E gamma. It's a safely very small. What's exciting is the fact that if you take if you take the simplest neutrino mass model and you ask, how large could these rates be? The answer is they could be really large. So these rates could be as high as the current experimental bounds. And this, by the way, is what you get if you take the seesaw mechanism that I wrote down, and you ask yourself, what could be the largest contribution of the seesaw mechanism to mu to E gamma? Don't ask me how that works, but it works. It's really, really ugly. You are relying on ridiculous cancellations amongst different parameters in your mass matrix to get non-zero neutrino masses. But nonetheless, you get these very, very large potential rates for these phenomena. The reason I like to show this plot is just to say that since we don't know how neutrino masses happen, we don't know what the quote-unquote standard model expectation for charged lepton flavor violation is. It could be way higher than 10 to the minus 54 G, 10 to the minus 54. And the flip side of that is, by looking for charged lepton flavor violation, we could be learning something about how neutrino masses happen, which is kind of the main thing that I'm talking about.
Why is there this funny kink in the curve, so the long
Because that's when you get cut off by the experimental bound.
But lower curves have it
as... Oh, because at this bound is making these curves also be bound as well. They are correlated. Okay, so I'm not going to talk about this or this because Doug talked about that. Because I'm almost out of time. I think we started like 5 minutes late. I do want to say another thing which is interesting about intensity frontier experiments as well. And the message is usually that what you're looking for in these intensity frontier experiments is the coefficient of some effective operator. Right? So you have a charged lepton flavor violation. You can translate that into the coefficient of one or a few effective operators. So the question is, what do we learn from that? So let's say that we see mu to e gamma tomorrow. So the question is, what are we any smarter? And the answer is yes, because we know that there's some new phenomenon. We know the effective scale of that new phenomenon. So we know that there are new particles with a mass that's below something, but that's all we know. So how do we make progress on that? The way to make progress is to measure more of these phenomena. And that's kind of how it worked out with the weak interactions. You know, we measured beta decay, then we measured muon decay and pion decay. And by combining all of that information, and after a lot of confusion that took like 30 years, we figured out that it was more likely to be a V minus A interaction. And that taught us something about the nature of the mediator, for example. So if we saw something like mu to e gamma tomorrow, that would be the situation we would be in, and we would need a lot of help. So these experiments tend to help themselves. You learn a lot by comparing these things with, say, G minus 2, or searches for new particles that come in other ways. There's a fun thing to think about in terms of mu to e conversion, which is if you measure mu to e conversion in different nuclei, you can tell, in quotes, the nature of the effective operator. This, by the way, is a relativistic effect. It's that at the non-relativistic level, all the effective operators look the same. But once your nuclei get very big, then you start having these relativistic effects. And then you can tell the different operators apart, which is why this is always drawn as a function of z. So this is a measure of the branching ratio in nucleus with number z relative to aluminum. And of course, at aluminum, the ratio is 1, which is around here. But then you start to get some divergence there. And that's how you start to learn a little bit about the nature of the effective operator. But the key thing is that you need these big nuclei. And that's probably not easy to do from an experimental point of view. Fortunately, the people who made this plot don't care about doing the experiment. So they can talk about, you know, these z equals 80 nuclei. I think that might be lead or something like that. Or, I don't know, uranium. It doesn't matter. OK, so this story I know is correct. So if you look at, say, mu to e gamma compared with the g minus 2 of the muon, it's also the same operator, except that this one is mu mu and this one is mu e. And the story is the same. If you believe that the new physics violates flavor by a lot, then this lambda scale is about 1,000 TeV. So there's no way that this has anything to do with the muon g minus 2. On the flip side, if the muon g minus 2 is new physics, whatever that new physics is, it really hates to violate flavor. It really thinks violating flavor is a very bad idea. So the bound on this thing is about 10 to the minus 4 on this effective mixing angle. OK, so this is something to do about taus. We already heard about that. And this is kind of a combination of these intensity frontier experiments and how we hope to make progress by comparing charged lepton flavor violation with the G minus 2 and with collider experiments. And depending on what we see, we hopefully will get some guidance about what to do next. And so there are all different kinds of possibilities. The worst of all worlds is probably this one. And this seems to be where we live today. And the question is, if we happen to end up here, then you know, let's say 10 years from now, it will be interesting to figure out what do we do next. And you can add EDMs to this list. And if they don't see anything either, then we'll be asking ourselves lots of hard questions. Good. And I didn't get to talk about neutrino experiments at all, because that's what I guess Kevin will do that. But I do want to say that what I left out of this story is neutrino oscillation experiments. And remember, we're talking about how do we learn more about non-zero neutrino masses. I think the message here, and I'll just say this in words because I've run out of time, is we've only seen neutrino masses in neutrino oscillation experiments. So if we want to learn more about where neutrino masses come from, even if you didn't know anything, or especially if you don't know anything, it sounds very reasonable to look for it in neutrino oscillation experiments. Because that's the only place where you know you're going to see something. Now, it doesn't mean that by doing neutrino oscillation experiments, you will learn about the origin of non-zero neutrino masses. Okay, so that's not a guarantee, but we're not going to find out until we actually do the experiments and get there and see what the answer is. What I did want to say, and this is the part which I'll just say in words, is that the challenge that we're in right now is the fact that we're getting to a point where we know how to measure things using neutrino oscillations. And we know what well-defined, interesting questions are. So we know, for example, that we can ask if the neutrinos violate CP. And we actually know how to get the answer. And the answer is we have to do these neutrino oscillation experiments at the percent level. And if you've never thought about this, this is very, very scary. Because neutrino oscillation experiments are really hard. They're hard for different reasons. One reason is, so if you don't know anything like me, neutrino experiments have to be really big. Because neutrino cross-sections are very small. And oscillations don't help, because oscillations require that you build your detector 1,000 kilometers away. That's not the way to start if you have a very, very tiny flux to begin with, and your cross-section is very small, and you have to be 1,000 kilometers away. That means that your detector has to be ridiculously big. But then you have to do a precision measurement. So you have this, a 10 kiloton detector, and you have to measure your event at the percent level. And it's actually worse than that, because you have to measure an effect that changes with energy. That means you have to know the neutrino energy very well. And surprise, surprise, our beams are not monochromatic neutrino beams. They're very broad. And the neutrino doesn't like to tell us what its energy is. The energy manifests itself in the decay, in the daughter products of the reaction that leads to this collision. And we have to use that information to reconstruct what the neutrino energy was to begin with. So that means we have to understand really well what's going on when the neutrino hits something. We have to measure really well the stuff that comes out. And we probably have to infer all of the stuff that comes out that we don't get to see.
I actually meant the much simpler problem, which is that if you were going to pick an energy to do a neutrino,
and then there's that.
You would never pick one GeV.
Oh, yeah, and then on top of that, yeah, that's the worst energy to calculate anything, because everything contributes at the same level. But Kevin will talk about that a lot.
I will.
And if he won't, Kendall will, and maybe Gabe will.
Oh, I have a question, but I didn't want to, stop you while you're in the middle of that. So what do you think the biggest surprise you might see at an experiment like this would be? I mean, because you're talking about CP violation, we all expect to see that.
So,
some of the other things that we expect to measure, they rule out families of models and whatnot, but they aren't
good. So that
what would be the biggest game changer at something like that?
That's I don't talk in hypotheticals, but no, that's the answer is what we really would like to start doing with Dune is to actually start constraining this three flavor model hypothesis. So again, we have this idea that works really well, that there are three neutrinos, there's a 3x3 mixing matrix, there are three different mass eigenstates, and four mixing parameters that we can constrain from experiment. So this is a good idea. It's a very plausible idea. It's the thing that you come up with by doing the least amount of work, and it fits all the data that we have access to today really well. However, if you ask yourself whether we've tested that hypothesis, the answer is we have not. So we have a simple hypothesis that fits all the data, but we haven't asked if that hypothesis is correct or not. So I think what the Dune experiment and the Hyper-K experiments will be able to do is to start testing whether that hypothesis is correct or not. So I think that will be the biggest contribution to all of this, is to take this model that works very well, this three-flavor model, and then testing that in a non-trivial way, which we've not been able to do that at all yet. And so a big surprise would be if we found out that that hypothesis is incorrect. And I think this is this next generation of experiments will be the first generation of experiments that can say something non-trivial about this very difficult question. And again, if you follow the quark flavor physics, that's how we did it in the quark flavor sector. You know, when Khabibul wrote down his model and when CKM wrote down the model, it was a great idea. It was very simple and it was testable and it was a model that you could try to falsify. And people did that and they worked on it for like 30 years. And they did that with 100 different observables and they can convince everybody that this CKM model works really well. But in order to do that, you really have to try to over-constrain your model. And in the neutrino sector, we haven't been able to do that by any stretch of the imagination. We've only measured a few things, and they all fit within the hypothesis, but we can't test the hypothesis. So I think this is what we're, this is the new information that we're going to get. So a surprise would be if somehow we find a mismatch that says, you know, for example, imagine you have two experiments measuring theta 1-3, and you get different answers for what theta 1-3 should be. This is a sign that your hypothesis was incorrect. And it's only now, actually right now, with the T2K experiment and the NOVA experiment and the reactor experiments, we're starting to get a glimpse of doing things that look like that. And I think with the Dune experiment, we'll be able to say something more intelligent.
I guess just one quick follow-up. Something that worries me, I don't know if it worries you, I get the impression that when people are doing long baseline data analysis, that they're fundamentally assuming the three flavor model, and they're using that in the calculations in a way that might make it hard to do what you're trying to get at.
So this is
something you worry about? Yes, I
think we're getting better at it, and I think the issue is, are we always too conservative when we talk about what these experiments will do? And I think the answer is yes, because we always give very boring talks. I mean you, the collaboration people. but I think on the flip side, what people often complain about is that we don't have good benchmarks for what this new physics could be. And maybe if we had a benchmark for what the new physics could be, we could start talking about that benchmark and say, hey, my experiment can test this benchmark new physics scenario at this level. And I don't think that's a bad idea. And I think we're starting to move towards that. I've done work on this. Pilar has done a lot of work on this. Is to ask, you know, what new physics model you could have, and how well could you test that model if you did the Dune experiment or if you did the Hyper-K experiment. These are things like non-standard interactions, steroneutrinos, finite neutrino lifetimes, things of that nature. These are all things you can try to test in a neutrino oscillation experiment. And I think if we all learn how to speak in that language, that might be fruitful. The flip side of this is that many of these models are weird, and they're kind of ad hoc, and they have no good reason for being, except that you can test them in a neutrino oscillation experiment. And I think once we made peace with that, I think we could define a language that goes along that direction. And I think the community is starting to pay more attention to this. So again, I know that within the Dune collaboration, there's more work going into looking into these non-trinoutrino hypotheses and asking how well you could test those. And I think it's important because it gives you something else you can talk about, and then it allows you to define whether, you know, my experiment is better than yours or vice versa. And I think that's something that I think we're going to start going in that direction.
I think we're going to have to stop here and continue the discussion because we are getting really late. So let's thank Andre again.